Hello, I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager, and welcome to the In Conversation With series, a series where I speak to notable figures in the realm of financial services. Listen as they share their personal journeys, thoughts on the industry, and advice for aspiring advisors. Hello, and welcome to the In Conversation series with Jordan Sriharan, fund manager from Canada Life Asset Management. So Jordan, if you could give us more an introduction to yourself, that would be great.
Sure. Thank you, Kimberly. So my name is Jordan Sriharan. I'm currently a fund manager on the multi-asset desk at Canada Life Asset Management.
Okay, great. And how did you get started in financial services?
Yeah, so I was the generation that began just as the financial crisis was taking shape. So it was 2007 in December, and I joined an endowment called the Wellcome Trust, which was an amazing place to start your career. You know, this is investing in it. When you invest in perpetuity, as they do for the charity, you know, it takes you to all parts of the world and all different asset classes. And I spent the best part of 5 years there, did the CFA and other exams you have to do in this world to kind of, tick along. And from there, I went to Mercer, and I was there as a consultant helping to manage pension fund money, predominantly UK pension fund money on the defined benefit schemes. Did that for a few years before I ended up my last job, which was Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, where I was head of the model portfolio service. So my background has been multi-asset in its entirety, jack of all trades, master of none, as they say. And I spent 8 years there, very enjoyable time, more on the private wealth side, managing private client money. And now I'm at Canada Life on the asset management side, where we're running similar approach, but the client bank is perhaps a bit different. We're running money for intermediaries and independent financial advisors through unit trusts, through unitized products, rather than through platforms where MPSs are typically managed.
And is there a particular area that you favor? Like, is it the asset management now? Is that?
Well, I think the thing with asset management is that it is able to be a lot more nimble in the way it manages portfolios. When you look at some of what happens in private wealth, it can be cumbersome. Platforms are difficult. Getting access to all different underlying holdings can be difficult. So it's a different way of accessing the end client. And what I believe Canada Life do very well with their insurance background, with a very distinct fixed income element to managing, you know, the asset liability management portfolios, is that there is a focus on risk management. And that was really important to me, which is when you're running risk controlled, risk profiled, volatility managers, a lot of different language used on the risk profiling side. When you're managing strategies that have to be pinned to a particular risk profile because the end client needs to stay within certain parameters, risk management is absolutely key. And I think the background here with their insurance mindset means that we run very nimble but very focused portfolios. And by focused, I mean there's a lot of work that goes in both pre and post trade to understand scenario analysis. If we add in this position, what's it going to do to our volatility? Once it's been added in, has it done what we thought it would do? And what you do tap into on the asset management side that's very, very useful is a team of people around you, not just other fund managers from the equity and fixed income side, but also a performance team, a risk team, a marketing function that allow you, well, particularly on the portfolio management side, allow you to do your job more effectively because there are other people helping you to understand what your volatility is from a day-to-day basis, how your performance has been, and they're feeding in to kind of the broader intellectual capital of our product.
Okay. And so this year has seen quite a lot of changes and quite a lot of ups and downs in terms of the markets and the impact that, you know, politics and global politics has had. And what would you say your experience has been of that in your current role this year?
Our experience, sorry, of the political environment in 2022.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's It's been fascinating. I guess there's a thing with portfolio management that I have always been quite focused on, which is politics is hugely important, but you have to separate what's noise in the political sphere from what is going to impact, you know, price of assets. And in some years, political noise is just that, you know, it's a story local to your own government. But the one thing that I think we were conscious of was when Russia invaded Ukraine back in February, March time, that was clearly a political situation that was going to impact asset prices. And it's something that we were kind of consciously aware of, started to position some of our portfolio to try and minimize the impact from that, if that's a fair thing to say. But yeah, it's one of those things where the politics don't really matter, and then all of a sudden it does matter, if that makes sense. And actually, you know, I was talking about sometimes how local politics don't matter as much, but if you fast forward to the end of September and, you know, the announcement of the Liz Truss government,
yes,
what I did to gilt yields, that again, you know, led us to make decisions in the to make decisions within the portfolio, where we were actually buying some of those index linked gilts at the end of September, which had dropped, you know, hugely in price. And we were buying them at, you know, 72, 73p for some long dated index linked gilts that had been battered by markets. And actually in the space of 1 or 2 weeks, you know, they'd gone back to a par 100, and actually we end up selling out at more like 125 pence for those bonds. So political volatility actually this year has brought a lot more opportunity than we've traditionally seen. So I guess it's a case of, you know, if I think about those two particular stories, they were idiosyncratic, right? They kind of came out of nowhere almost, which is different to the midterms in the US, where people think about which sectors might, you know, outperform if the Democrats, you know, retain the House, and which, you know, which might outperform if the Republicans come into to play. And so that's a different way of thinking about politics. But this year has certainly provided us with some volatility that's allowed us to, we think, help the portfolio in its returns this year.
Yeah. And you were talking about those opportunities. So what are your what's your outlook for the opportunities that may be there for 2023? I know that obviously, like this year, like you were saying, there was no predicting what would happen. But what opportunities do you see there are in 2023?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting point to make about predicting. And I think predicting, forecasting can be quite a fruitless task. And actually, I'm not even sure that is the best way to invest in the long term, by making short term predictions. But, you know, if we look ahead to 2023, a bit of it is being humble, is knowing that it's actually It's not easy to know how things play out in 2023. And I guess everybody says that at the start of a new year, it's hard to forecast how things plan out. But the key difference between going into next year and the past 10 years is that we know central banks are not going to come along with a big bazooka of QE and rescue asset prices if they sell off for reasons we aren't to understand yet. And that is a big difference between forecasting this year and years gone by. And I think when we look into 2023, you kind of have to have the back or the rear view mirror of 2022 to focus your mind on where the opportunities may lie. So if I think about fixed income, for example, long has fixed income been derided by investors as this, you know, comically termed return-free risk, i.e., you know, zero yields on government bonds and some high credit quality investment grade corporate bonds, you know, mean that they're a no-go area. And, you know, and I think what's happened this year is that particular story has come to play out. Now, I would argue that those same people have been calling the death of the bond market for the past 10 years. And so 1 year in 10, I suppose, isn't a bad record. But I say that tongue in cheek, because I think in 2023, we're moving into an environment where actually fixed income is now a very viable asset class to invest in your multi-asset portfolio. And if I think about, you can buy, you know, medium dated debt, you know, US investment grade at 6% yield, that's really quite appealing. You know, I know we have inflation in the background, and we can come on to talk about that. But if you think about the, we've had the, I think one of the worst returns for government bonds in the past 100 years. And if I think about some of the low risk portfolios that are down 7 or 8%, if you think you can get 6% from a bond in its income and the price stays flat for the whole year, that's quite an appealing opportunity. And so when we think about 2023, we are looking at, we have been a bit more nimble in our fixed income allocation. So I can give you an example of, in the last month, we have purchased a long dated US Treasury position because we felt that those yields on the long end of the US curve had just, you know, had gone quite far, and the market was pricing in too many rate hikes. And we've been able, in our kind of satellite part of the fixed income portfolio, to generate some quite sizable returns just over 1 month. It was it was a kind of a medium term investment case that's ended up being quite short term in its returns. And so it's about thinking where an asset or a sub-asset class sold off materially and has got to such a point where it's so cheap, it really does warrant, you know, an investment. And that's what we've been doing a lot in the past month. And that's where we think we'll be able to, we can sleep a bit safer at night with fixed income and our allocation there than we can with the equity market, which is on a slightly different, the equity market narrative, I think, at the moment, is that we'll have a soft landing, it'll be okay, and we'll, you know, we'll tick along quite nicely. And I think the problem with that is that there is, as we know, there's a recession coming, and as we know, some, you know, the US has already had one negative quarter of GDP this year, and it's highlighted to have another one or two, or perhaps even three next year. So I think equities are not pricing in a recession, whereas fixed income is, and that is why we're a bit more positive on bonds and a bit more negative on equities. And that's not a blanket, you know, equities are bad, they're going to sell off hugely once the consumer demand craters post, I don't know, higher energy prices, you know, higher interest rates on mortgages. There's a lot of bad news priced into the real economy. I'm not sure equities have quite got the right valuations in place, if that makes sense. And so equities, don't get me wrong, I think there are opportunities in different regions and different sectors and different factors. But slightly more happy with our fixed income allocation to help, particularly our lower risk portfolios, prop up returns next year.
Okay. And you've mentioned like the weaker dollar slightly earlier. So what ways can you find to avoid exposure to that weaker dollar in 2023?
Yeah, it's a really interesting time for multi-asset investors. And the weaker dollar argument is really that we have probably hit a peak in inflation in the US. We've probably peaked in terms of hawkishness around the Federal Reserve in terms of rate rises. It's almost, well, it's priced in now that they'll have 50 basis points in their December meeting, having done three lots of 75 in a row. And so the dollar, if you look at the DXY index and other, and versus, you know, the yen and versus sterling, has had a fantastic run in 2022. And we are sterling-based investors predominantly. And when we've looked, and when you do look at previous episodes, and sterling, sure, it sold off during the year because of political, you know, ramifications, but actually a lot of it was still the dollar rallying pretty hard because they were quick to raise rates. You know, their monetary policy approach is a lot more dynamic than the rest of the world, and, you know, rates were not quickly and hard, and kind of they were trying to pull, you know, the rug under inflation as quickly as possible. And so the dollar went up very quickly. When you look at other episodes where sterling has crashed significantly, whether it be 2000 during the dot-com crash, whether it be 2008 or the financial crisis, whether it be 2016 post-Brexit, Mm-hmm. What we've seen, and I appreciate this is only three events out of the last 20 years, when you see the following year, sterling versus dollar has been higher on each occasion. And I think because currencies overreact in, you know, particularly in certain cases on the downside, there is this kind of rebuild of expectations where investors go, well, actually, it wasn't as bad as that. And actually, sterling can often be higher at year end. And so I should frame that in from the point of view that that is a short-term view, that sterling versus dollar will be better next year, but perhaps not in 2024. And that confluence of kind of points means that you have to think about what's my long-term position, but in the short term, what do I want to do to profit from the fact that if the dollar's weaker, my returns in dollars from overseas assets are going to be weaker as well. And so if I think, I don't get too technical, but in our core positions, particularly in equities, where we're unhedged, we're kind of okay for that to remain unhedged. It's been a long-term position, and we kind of unhedge our, or leave our equity overseas exposure unhedged, and we broadly hedge our fixed income exposure. And where we were unhedged last year, we've now, you know, decided to hedge that from dollar weakness. But just on my point about the equity space, I think, and we have been doing this, when we're looking at ideas that may be more short-term, because I think we live in a slightly more short-term investment horizon than we did before, if we want to put on a particular position, we are extremely aware of whether a weaker dollar next year is going to detract from returns. So I'll give you an example of our thinking and what we've done, we're thinking of doing at the moment, is we're of the view that what's been the big industry leaders of the last 4 or 5 years that have sold off a bit are not going to be the same sectors that lead us out of this, you know, recovery in the global economy. It won't be the more growthier businesses. It won't be the more tech, you know, driven businesses that will be the big winners as we recover in 2023. It will be the more cyclical value industrial names that we think are going to outperform. And so if we want to be positioned to the US economy and the US equity market in particular, the S&P 500, do we want to just own that market cap index? Because actually, if tech is the biggest constituent along with communication services, which is, you know, Facebook, Meta and Google, do we actually, you know, do we want to own big slugs of those sectors, or do we want to own an equally weighted sector S&P position where the industrials, consumer staples, maybe the more value parts of that equity market in the S&P are now given an equal footing? And so we think that could do quite well in 2023, mainly because it's underweight tech versus, you know, the index and so on. But we do recognize that probably is only a 1 year story, maybe two at the most. And so how do we do that? How do we express that position but not lose it if the dollar is weaker next year? And so we've hedged a position in an equally weighted S&P 500 ETF because that actually is a good way of playing short-term movement in the market where we think returns will be next year, but not losing it from a weaker dollar and from sterling strength, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's a convoluted way of answering your question. Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is in the long run, we're not traders. We're not trying to guess, you know, where FX valuations should be.
Yeah.
We do know in the short run, sterling has gone a long way on the downside, and we don't want to erode returns with, let's call it, shorter term ideas, because we haven't hedged the currency, because we haven't thought about the overall picture in 2023.
Yeah. No, I think that's quite good insight into what could possibly happen. But I think finally, for our audience, they may have clients who have worries or concerns that they're bringing to them in terms of their investments. And what would your advice be to those advisors who are kind of going out there and speaking to their clients on a regular basis, who are concerned about inflation and, you know, general cost of living crisis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, perhaps I can speak from a portfolio management perspective, in terms of where, you know, their client portfolios. You know, 2022 was a kind of one in 30, running 40-year event where both equities and bonds were down a lot, and actually almost down as much as each other. A lot of noise has been made about how far fixed income has dropped this year, but if you look at, you know, global equity markets in the US, it's down almost as much if you limit it in dollars, so to speak. What is to if you know, clients who are worried, I think what I would say, you know, on the front foot is that 2023 should bring about better returns for portfolios. Now, I'm sure intermediaries and financial advisors talk to their clients all the time about the benefits of long-term investing, compounding out your returns, making sure that you're generating income in the right areas that you can then, you know, compound out the, you know, other parts of your portfolio. I wouldn't want to sit here and say performance will be positive next year, because that's not really a fair thing to say. But what I will say is the market has discounted, and by that I mean priced in, a lot of the bad news that is set to occur. And you have this phenomenon in finance where financial markets work ahead of the real economy. So investors have seen that there's going to be, you know, weaker earnings, weaker consumer demand that's going to impact profitability on some of those businesses in the global economy. And those and the prices of those businesses, whether it be an advertising sensitive company like Google, or whether it be a consumer discretionary business, the share price of those companies have come down a fair bit this year. And you only have to, you know, that's actually made, you know, national news as well as kind of financial news.
Yeah. And
I guess my point is, when we go into next year, I think the real economy catches up. And by that, I mean, in the real economy, we start to see, you know, 6 months of energy price hikes start to impact people's disposable income. We start to see more people moving from, let's call them lower interest rate mortgages to higher interest rate. And this is all going to impact consumer demand. And you're going to see profitability come down further in some of these companies. But a lot of that is already priced in. And so I think what happens next year is we get to kind of the middle part of the year, and it's kind of everyone, but I mean the broad global consumer is feeling the pinch hard. And they'll look at the equity markets and go, oh, they don't seem to be, you know, they don't seem to be down hugely this year. And I think that's because we've had lots of the pain already this year. And next year is kind of a new slate, but also I think an opportunity for good companies with good profitability in different sectors to outperform. And that's where your advisor, through his investment manager, through the fund that they're managed in, can generate returns. And so don't worry that the growth and particularly tech names have had a stumble, and that may continue for you know, another year or two or three. But if your investment manager is nimble, if he's not dogmatic about the way he thinks about investing, and some peers are, you know, talk about themselves as growth investors, you know, they're multi-asset people, really. They're not growth investors, they're multi-asset. What we think is important, what we do well, is not being dogmatic, but being pragmatic and going, well, actually value, I can send some graphs your way that show you that value growth had these big periods of outperformance, and there's a sharp correction for a couple of years or three or four, and then growth comes back as the economic cycle ticks back to normal.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is position the portfolio towards more value ideas, more industrial, more cyclical positions that aren't going to be dragged down by what we think is further weakness in growth type assets. So I would say to those clients, there are opportunities. One, because some assets are already at very, very deep discounts to their value. And the other, because there's opportunity in other parts of the global economy, whether it be by sector, whether it be by asset class. You know, we've talked a lot in the last week, two or three, about, you know, the high yield market in Asia. We've always typically allocated to the US and Europe, but actually the Asian high yield market looks relatively attractive. You know, the yields there are phenomenally high, 19-20%. And given how much that market has sold off this year, that's quite an interesting opportunity for us to look at, albeit in smaller size than we'd have in our US or our European high yield for you know, risk management reasons. But there's lots of opportunity as well. And I think that will lead to the more nimble investor, the more thoughtful investor generating, you know, robust returns next year, because they've been pragmatic and because they thought about where is the world going to next? And where I'd be worried is if I had an investment manager who was saying to me, oh, we love growth. It's the only equity style to have, or we love this, or we love that, and we're going to keep owning those names because they'll do well in time. That's where I'd be worried. I think what we try to do, we will say we don't love anything, we don't hate anything, right, in terms of asset classes. We're trying to just be removed from the hype of it, removed from the behavioral biases you have that can come into play for any reason. And yeah, think, well, actually, has that particular asset sold off enough for us to warrant an investment in it? Are we comfortable that China is reopening and is serious about it? Are we happy the property market in China is going to be supported going into next year? And those sort of things lead us into an investment into the Asian high yield market, which has a fair amount of exposure to Chinese property developers. So that's not something that we've done, and we may look at it in the start of the new year. But I'm just saying the opportunities are everywhere because we've had such a steep sell-off. So if you've got somebody who has shown themselves to be pragmatic, can be nimble, will be nimble, and think of new ideas, then there's a good chance you could do quite well. But this is not for me to pick on the peer group. But if people are quite dogmatic in their approach, my suspicion is that they'll struggle for another year or two until growth, has its comeuppance again and it kind of is off to the races. So, and that's not to say be worried, don't be worried. It's just to say look under the bonnet of what your portfolio is and with your advisor say, what is this particular strategy trying to do? What's that trying to do? And get a good idea of whether you think they're doing a good job for you. But yeah, I'm not trying to waffle too much, but you will have years like this. And I would say to those clients as well, we've had since 2008 or 2009, let's say, we've had almost, 10, 11, 12 years of great returns. And so we should ignore how far we've come. But when interest rates go up as fast as they have done and may be there for some time, think about, is your portfolio, does it have a new playbook or is it sticking to the old script? Because I think the old script is going to struggle in a world of higher interest rates for the next year or two.
Yeah, I think that is all very valid and very good advice. But thank you so much for speaking with me today, Jordan. I look forward to 2023 and see how everything pans out.
Great. Thank you for your time, Kimberly. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation With. We do hope that you enjoyed it. Please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your podcasts from. You can also keep up to date with all our new content published on the Money Marketing website, as well as our print edition Money Marketing magazine. So make sure to subscribe. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. See you next time.